Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the second hour, we continue our conversation with Sergey Tripkovic for just a few minutes, talking about jihad. And then we'll be joined by Scott Klusendorf. The Missouri Stem Cell Initiative is going to be the subject, and of course we'll get his reaction to some of our interview with Don Rubin last week, president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures. They're the ones pushing this initiative in Missouri. It claims it will ban all human cloning, but in fact it does not. And some new words have been invented in order to defend and to promote embryonic stem cell research. Scott Klusendorf will react to all that in the 5 o'clock hour. Audio open lines to begin with. And then we're going to play Name That Religion. We've got 4 sound bites. This is like Name That Church Body, but it's just a little bit different. We're going to have 4 sound bites. We're going to play them in a certain order. We're going to tell you that in this group of 4 sound bites, there's a Roman Catholic, there's a Lutheran, there's a Jew, and there's a Muslim. We want you to tell them apart and tell us, what order are we playing them in? And we'll give you plenty of time to call in that last half hour as we play Name That Religion here on Issues, Etc. Dr. Sergey Tripkovic is a foreign affairs editor for Chronicles Magazine, a magazine of American culture, and author of the book Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terror Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Sergey, recently I was listening to an interview with Thomas Friedman. He's written a new book, and one of the things he said was that at the very heart of the terrorist impulse among the Muslims is humiliation. And he put it this way. He says, look, in the 21st century, you get your humiliation at the speed of light. You can see it on television as it's coming to you. And the Muslim considers his religion to be the highest form of monotheism. He considers himself, in Friedman's terms, to have monotheism version 3.0. Christians are maybe monotheism version 2.0. Jews, monotheism version 1.0. And when they look at a world that is excelling, a world of, in particular, a Christian world that is excelling beyond Islamic culture, they feel humiliation. He says when you talk to these young Muslims, the word that often comes up in their conversation often is humiliation. What do you make of Friedman's assessment?
To tell you the truth, it sounds like so much psychobabble. If you look at the empirical evidence through the centuries, you notice very similar patterns of behavior even at a time when the Islamic world was very successful, when it was both militarily and socially and economically way ahead of the majority of European countries. And this explanation would probably be correct to some extent, at least, if we had the terrorist mindset and the jihadist violence as the response of the Muslim world to the crisis of its weakness over the past 100 years or over the past 200 years. But in view of the fact that this same behavior pattern has been repeated time and over again, both when it is on the upswing and when it's on a downward spiral, indicates that, in fact, there is something deeper, that there is both the scriptural basis and the elimination of moral discernment that enables the jihadist mindset to control people's destinies and to take people's allegiances.
You know, it seems then a huge point to be made that is simply not made. We are often told, and sometimes simply it is assumed, that terrorism, the product of poverty, or the product of a backward culture, or the product of, as Friedman puts it, just kind of general global humiliation that the Muslim suffers in the mass media. You say even when there's political majority, even when there's when their culture excels, the impulse for jihad is still there.
Absolutely. And also, again, to refute Friedman a step further, if you look at very similar societies in sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, in Uganda, in Nigeria, you will notice very different responses to poverty, to the crisis of humiliation, as he puts it. Because it would stand to reason that Africans living on a dollar a day will behave in a similar fashion and display the same propensity to terrorist violence, it is not at all the case. It is only those who kiss the carpet in the direction of Mecca that betray certain behavioral patterns and modes of thought that take one in the direction of terrorist violence.
Let's talk with Barry. He calls from Washington, D.C. Barry, thanks for waiting. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, Todd. Thank you for this wonderful program, and I'm sorry if this has already been asked. I was just going to say, first of all, I just accepted an offer to go back to Iran today, so I'll be back there in 6 weeks. So I'm looking forward to that. But I'd like to ask your guest, it seems like our foreign policy and national policy is bent on unifying the Arab world, I mean the Muslim world, instead of playing off the natural hostilities between Persian, Turk, and Arab, Shia, Sunni, and all those things. Are we forcing them together and making them stronger?
Good question, Barry.
It is an excellent point, and the one that I've made in my various writings, both in the print edition of Chronicles and online, that the Iraqi intervention in particular has provided the kind of focal point that the jihadists could only hope for, and that it doesn't make much sense, on the one hand, to have an ultra-activist policy in the Muslim world going around spreading democracy, if you will, and at the same time have a domestic immigration policy that does not allow for any form of ethno-religious profiling in the selection of people who are allowed to come in and settle and get green cards and passports. Now, it should be completely reversed. On the one hand, we should seek to disengage from the affairs of the Muslim world. On the other hand, we should seek to make the homeland more secure by creating an explicit, very frank correlation between suitability of newcomers to obtain residence, to obtain citizenship, and frankly, if someone shouts racism, the response will be, no, it's not, because this concerns political beliefs and radical revolutionary mindset. How come that, for instance, Lebanese Christians or Syrian Christians or Egyptian Christians are eminently capable of integrating into their host community and being highly respected and well-liked members of that community, and we only have problems with the Muslims? Now, in response to your caller's question, I also believe that it is possible to subtly play on the inherent rivalries within the Islamic world, but in order to do so, the United States needs to step aside. For as long as it pursues its activist interventionist policy in that part of the world, then all the intra-Muslim rivalries will be secondary to the shared anger and to the shared sense of angst that breeds terrorist violence. I'm not suggesting for a moment that disengagement from the affairs of the Muslim world would solve the problem of terrorism per se, but certainly it ought to be accompanied by a sane immigration policy that would deny the jihadist fifth column a foothold in the Western world.
With only 30 seconds, do you foresee a time when there will come from within Islam that ability, as you write in your book, to be self-reflective, an Islam that can reflect upon jihad and upon Islam?
If it were to occur, it would no longer be Islam. It would be something else. And even when you have people who advocate that kind of revision, it is always the hardliner, it is always the Orthodox who have the upper hand and who also have the ability even to threaten the physical existence of would-be reformers. It is a very melancholy situation, but the one that unfortunately is rooted both in the scriptural basis of Islam and in the historical experience of its upholders.
Dr. Serge Trifkovic is a foreign affairs editor for Chronicles, a magazine of American culture. He's author of the book, Defeating Jihad, How the War on Terror Can Be Won in Spite of Ourselves. Serge, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for being our guest.
It was my pleasure to be with you again.
This voter referendum measure will ensure that Missouri patients have access to any stem cell cures that are allowed under federal law. It will ensure that our medical institutions can provide and help develop those cures. And it resolves the cloning issue by banning any attempt to clone a human being.
Well, you've probably heard that, and it comes from an ad being played in Missouri leading up to the Missouri Stem Cell Initiative. It comes from the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cure. Sounds like a great organization. Well, last week, we had the opportunity to interview Don Rubin, the president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, about this initiative, about whether it, well, basically bans all human cloning, as it says it does, and some of the new terms that are being invented in order to garner support for embryonic stem cell research. Joining us to get his reaction to our interview with Don Rubin and also to discuss it in general, Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute, a regular guest here on the program. Scott, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
First of all, does any of this look familiar to you? The kind of ads that are being run, the way it's being sold to the public as an initiative, and the new language that's being invented in order to garner support for embryonic stem cell research?
Well, the language for the Missouri Stem Cell Research and Cures Initiative is nothing but pure lies. That's the kindest thing I can say about it. I have been in the bioethics world for 15 years now, Todd. A lot of what they're saying is a rehash of things we've heard on the abortion debate, only in this case, they are going overboard to mislead the public, and the deception that's going on here is just breathtaking. It's unbelievable for an organization to claim that their initiative bans human cloning when, in fact, that's precisely what it allows. And let me give you an example from their own fact sheet so that no one can accuse me of making things up about their initiative. Here's a quote. "We believe that all types of stem cell research should be pursued in an effort to find life-saving cures, including research involving adult stem cells, somatic cell nuclear transfer, and stem cells from excess fertility clinic embryos. We believe human cloning should be banned." End quote. Todd, somatic cell nuclear transfer is cloning, and Mr. Rubin knows it.
All right, here's a piece to that effect. This came from our interview last week, early last week, with Don Rubin, the president of Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, on that very subject.
Well, it's cloning of cells. It's not cloning a human being. It's a very important distinction.
Well,
what Missourians want to see banned, Todd, is the cloning of a person. This initiative will not only ban the cloning, but will ban any attempt to clone a baby, a person, a human being in the state of Missouri. What it will allow to go forward, however, is life-saving research in a laboratory dish where, yes, cells are cloned. But you know, Todd, cloning goes on all the time, and I don't think we want to ban all cloning. Cloning of cells, of genes, goes on when we produce insulin to treat diabetes patients, when we clone skin cells to create skin grafts for burn victims. Cloning goes on all the time. What we want to make sure happens is that nobody tries to clone a person in Missouri, and that's what this initiative bans with very strict criminal penalties.
Scott, it's just cloning of cells, not cloning of persons.
You know, I wish I had debated this guy on live on your show, because he is just lying through his teeth, and I'm not going to apologize for calling him a liar, because that's what he is. Let's be clear. Somatic cell nuclear transfer, which is the code word for cloning, does not clone cells. It clones a human embryo that we will then kill to get cells for research. He left out that little part in the middle about creating an embryo that we then use to get the cells that we need for research. He just glossed right over that one. He also said, and this was very deceptive, "Look, we would never clone a person." Notice he has suddenly drawn an arbitrary distinction between human being and human person, as if somehow the embryo is not yet a person. Excuse me, he provides no argument for saying that there can be such a thing as a human being that's not a person. He, again, just glosses right over that one. He then injected the word baby, and this is something that is used to play on the public sentiment. "Oh, well, we would never clone a baby." Look, pro-lifers like you and I, Todd, do not oppose somatic cell nuclear transfer, in other words, cloning, because it kills a baby. We oppose it because it takes the life of a defenseless human being, whatever its stage of development. Newborn, embryo, fetus, we don't care. The point is that procedure, that cloning procedure that will be used to derive stem cells, kills human embryos, and that's why we oppose it.
All right. I noticed the disingenuous nature of that first response as well, and so I simply asked Don Rubin in our interview last week, is the product of somatic cell nuclear transfer, in fact, a human embryo? Here's his response.
Well, I would say no. That the precise use of the term embryo, an embryo is created when typically in the case of natural fertilization, is created when the fertilized egg grows into a blastocyst, and that blastocyst, which is about a 5 or 6 or 7 day old clump of those cells, implants into a uterus. What? Only upon implantation into a uterus does the process of what's called differentiation take place, which is when these undefined cells begin to turn into blood cells, bone cells, nerve cells. That does not happen outside of the uterus. All we have outside the uterus in the lab dish are undefined cells, blank cells that have not differentiated into anything else.
What is it? What is it before it implants? I mean, in the case of natural fertilization, what is that before it implants?
It's called a blastocyst.
It's not an embryo.
It's not technically an embryo under medical definitions.
All right, Scott, is it technically an embryo under medical definitions?
This guy, I mean, his lying is just amazing. Look, if an embryo is not an embryo until it implants, why are we calling this embryonic stem cell research? If we're not getting the stem cells from embryos, what are we getting them from, frog legs? I mean, this guy is just disingenuous to the max. The other thing that's interesting is if we're going to say that it's not human until it implants, what are we going to do in 20 years when artificial wombs will be able to sustain fetuses through all 9 months of pregnancy? Would Mr. Rubin say then that it's okay to use late-term fetuses for destructive research because, after all, they haven't yet been implanted and may never be in a mother's womb? This is crazy stuff. This is no different than what we saw throughout history, whether we're talking about the Germans during the Second World War or any other time in history when there's a group trying to dehumanize a victim class they hope to exploit. And they use all this shady kind of language to fool the public into believing that human lives are not really being taken. I want Mr. Rubin to come on your show and present to you live on the air one credible medical textbook that will back up his claim that a human embryo does not exist until implantation. That's just nonsense. It's funny because more honest embryonic stem cell research advocates are willing to say, of course, it's a human embryo. That's what it is. That's the only thing from which we can get human embryonic stem cells for research. But here we have Mr. Rubin simply trying to lie through his teeth on the very direct question you asked him.
All right. Now, in line with what you just said there, two things. First of all, we asked Dr. Bill Hurlbut of the President's Council on Bioethics to respond to the very same thing. And on the issue of differentiation, he said, look, there is differentiation before the embryo implants. It's called the blastocyst wall and the stem cells inside. That is differentiation. Two different kinds of cells.
Exactly. And here's what is not being said by Mr. Rubin. The critical difference between a collection of cells and a living human embryo is the ability of the embryo to act in a coordinated manner for the continued health and maintenance of its body as a whole. Mere clumps of cells don't do that. In other words, if you can't see what I'm doing right now, but I'm plucking cells off the back of my hand. These cells are merely part of a larger human being, me. They are not distinct, whole living beings the way I was when I was an embryo, the way you were when you were an embryo. In other words, these cells on the back of my hand are merely part of a larger human being. They're not whole human beings the way the embryo is. The key difference here is that embryos function as coordinated organisms. They are not mere clumps of cells that are merely part of some other organism. And Mr. Rubin very deftly pulled that over the public eye again and tried to avoid making that distinction.
Now, Don Rubin did not use the term, but a caller after our interview, and we opened the lines for listeners' reaction, after our interview with Rubin, called in and tried to make the case that what we're looking at before implantation, after somatic cell nuclear transfer and before implantation, or for that matter, after fertilization and before implantation, is what he called a pre-embryo.
Yeah, that is a term that is very misleading. It has been thrown around for a number of years now, and it is strictly political in nature. In fact, pro-cloning advocate Lee Silver points out rather clearly that this term pre-embryo is nothing but an attempt to deceive the public. Let me quote him directly. He says, quote, "I'll let you in on a secret. The term pre-embryo has been embraced wholeheartedly by IVF practitioners for reasons that are political, not scientific." In other words, he is admitting here that there's no such thing as a pre-embryo. This is just another label we invent to allow us to dehumanize and destroy a class of human beings.
All right. Now, there was an argument made in the course of our conversation with Don Rubin of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures that I think probably, unexamined, would get a lot of support from the average person. Here's the argument he put forth to those like you and me, Scott, who oppose embryonic stem cell research on ethical grounds.
Now, if someone believes that those cells in a laboratory dish are a human being, they're certainly entitled to that opinion. I have no problem with that at all, and our members have no problem with that. However, those who oppose this research because they believe that those cells in a laboratory dish are the equivalent of a living, breathing child or adult who's suffering with the disease, those individuals have every right to turn their backs on the fruits of this research, but it's simply wrong for them to deny this hope to the rest of us. I think everyone agrees on the ethics. People need to decide what their philosophical position is, but no one believes we should be taking lives to save lives. But in this case, most people do not believe that those cells in a laboratory dish are a new human life.
All right, Scott. All right, how do you respond to the argument?
Yeah, let's go back to 1941 and try this soundbite. If you believe those Jews that we're using for medical experiments in the Nazi death camps are human beings, you are free to think that. We aren't asking you to change your mind. We're not insisting that you agree with us, but you have no right to oppose using them for life-saving medical research, especially when there's lots of people out there who need cures. Obviously, what's going on here is Mr. Rubin is simply assuming the embryos in question are not human beings. He simply glosses right over that subject, presents no argument that's credible to show that they're not human beings, other than to lie through his teeth and say they're pre-embryos. Well, I guess he didn't call it that, but he said they were not embryos until they are implanted. He ignores the question of what is the embryo and simply says, in essence, who are you, because of your outdated moral and religious beliefs, to oppose life-saving research? That's the gist of his argument. Well, what if it were true that killing two-year-olds would save a whole lot of people? Would it follow then that we were just opposing it because we had religious beliefs that were getting in the way of scientific progress?
We're talking with Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute, getting his reaction to our interview with Don Rubin, president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures. When we come back, we've got some more time with Scott. And then, during our 5 o'clock hour, we've got audio open lines. We'll play some audio for you, get your reaction, your questions, and your comments. And then we'll be playing Name That Religion in the last half hour. It's a little bit like Name That Church Body, but just slightly more complicated. Not too complicated. 4 sound bites. One from a Jew, one from a Muslim, one from a Catholic, one from a Lutheran. We're going to play them in the same order every time, and we want you to simply put it in the order that we're playing it in. Name That Religion. We'll play it in the last half hour of the program. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Dr. Dean Winthy, president of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider studying for the pastoral ministry.
It's the most beautiful and wonderful calling to expound the goodness and the grace of God in Christ and to spread the good news of Christ's victory over death. You're carrying eternal good news and the life of Christ through His Word, His sacraments. And we welcome any who want to consider the ministry to visit our faculty in action, our worship, because you'll see there the word of a loving and present God who has bestowed all things in Christ.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, call them toll-free 1-800-481-2155, or visit our website, issuesetc.org.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. July marks the 50th anniversary of the official recognition of the national motto, In God We Trust. Tennessee Congressman John Duncan wants to commemorate the event with a resolution reaffirming the motto and calling on Americans to reflect on the blessing of God on our nation. Terry Phillips reports.
The resolution encourages Americans to commemorate the national motto on or around July 30th with patriotic and sacred assemblies and prayer. Amanda Banks of Focus on the Family Action says while resolutions are not law, Congress uses them to express its opinion.
Resolutions are important. They do go into the congressional record, obviously, and they show congressional support.
The support might be needed as the motto is under attack in a federal court by atheist Michael Newdow.
I hope he gets it passed. He won't, but it's just like the best evidence I have for my case.
He's optimistic because the resolution refers to 16 historical findings, including the phrase, "This American trust in the Christian deity dates from the earliest colonial days." Attorney Jay Sekulow concedes that might cross the line.
Part of the resolution is absolutely fine that talks about the religious heritage of America, but the reference to a specific religion in the resolution probably would cause some problems.
But he thinks a legal challenge is unlikely. Constitutionality aside, historian David Barton says all the findings are historically accurate and it's appropriate to commemorate the anniversary.
A great way to serve and commemorate the national motto would be simply to read this resolution.
While the motto was officially adopted in 1956, it had been the unofficial motto since the Civil War when it began appearing on U.S. currency. For Family News in Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
The resolution finds, quote, "The historical fact of the fundamental trust of the American people upon the God of the Bible is irrefutable," and cites Psalm 33:12, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." For Family News in Focus,
AM 850 KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive. The folks at Reliable Heating and Cooling remind you that during this in-between season, between the extremes of winter and summer, it's generally easier to arrange for a service checkup on your furnace or your air conditioner. That tip courtesy of Reliable Heating and Cooling, 8463 Delport Drive, a corporate underwriter of AM 850 KFUO.
This year, Mother's Day is May 14th, and our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is all about moms. It's titled Mommy Promises. This picture book for children ages 4 and up costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Mommy Promises is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. More information is available on our website, issuesetc.org. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Mommy Promises.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the Missouri Stem Cell Initiative with Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute. You can check out their website. Go first to our website, issuesetc.org. Look on the left-hand side of the homepage, click links, scroll down, and you'll find Scott Klusendorf and Life Training Institute, issuesetc.org. You can join our conversation as we continue to react to our interview last week with Don Rubin, president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Scott, we were talking about the logic, the argument that was made by Don Rubin, wherein he says, look, if you object for ethical reasons to the and you think the embryo is equivalent to a living, breathing child with a disease, go ahead and believe it. But just don't deny the rest of us those cures. Go ahead and don't use the cures, but we'll still use them. I was thinking about the argument that could have been put forth in pre-Civil War America. The South did not want slavery to be universal. They just wanted to be able to practice it in their states. They could have said to the North, now look, if you want to continue, if you want to believe that the black man is a full human being and that slavery is wrong, go right ahead, but don't deny us the right to own our slaves.
Here's what he's saying. It's a really condescending position he's taking. He's basically saying to you and I, Todd, hey, you're free to believe whatever you want, but you're not free to act as if your belief is true. And that's condescending, it's patronizing, and it's intellectually dishonest. And you're absolutely right about the Civil War analogy. It fits perfectly. In fact, there were Southerners who argued that. It's called the doctrine of popular sovereignty. Hey, we're not going to answer the question of whether blacks have natural rights as human beings. We want each state to have the freedom to vote slavery up or down. That was Douglass's argument in principle.
All right, here's another response. I was curious whether or not, because the promises are so big when it comes to the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, they are promising a whole list of diseases that will that apparently are we're just on the cusp of curing these diseases if only we could get the legal and the financial means to do so. Well, I asked about whether there were any cures from embryonic stem cell research.
Embryonic stem cells is a brand new area of science. Embryonic stem cells were first isolated in 1998, so that's less than 8 years ago. You know, it takes 14 to 15 years for a new drug to be developed. So we're really on the cusp of a new frontier. One wouldn't expect for cures to have been developed yet. But in fact, the science is moving quite quickly, and human trials, there have already been successes in animal models. So Parkinson's disease has been cured in monkeys. Spinal cord injury has been cured in mice and rats.
With embryonic stem cells.
Yes, with embryonic stem cells.
All right, Scott, first of all, you're laughing.
More lies. Let's get clear here. The problems with embryonic stem cell research currently, I'm not saying it never will fix these problems, but right now, here are the facts. First, embryonic stem cells have yet to cure one known disease. I don't know why Mr. Rubin would want to deceive you on that point, ha-ha, but the fact of the matter is they haven't cured one single disease. Meanwhile, adult stem cell research that does not require killing an innocent human being in order to treat disease in someone else, those adult cells are currently treating 64 known diseases. In other words, the current score is 64 to nothing. Adult stem cells, which are ethical and I have no problem with, are treating 64, embryonic stem cells treating none. So for him to pretend that this is something that, oh, if we could just get these radical fundamentalists out of the way who are trying to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us, we could all be cured of everything from acne to Alzheimer's, is ridiculous. Secondly, he didn't talk about the costs involved with embryonic stem cell treatments. Let's talk about somatic cell nuclear transfer, this cloning procedure we talked about. It takes up to 100 human eggs per patient at a cost of $1,000 to $2,000 a piece just to derive one cloned embryonic stem cell line for use in regenerative therapy. That's unbelievably cost prohibitive. He also didn't talk about the fact that investors have failed to pony up the money for embryonic stem cell research because they don't see it as being promising the way he does. And so this is why he and others are running to the state legislators and to the ballot initiative process to try to fool the public into supporting this with their tax dollars. Again, there's not the kind of cure promise that he's claiming. Could it be the case that one day embryonic stem cells will result in therapies that are useful? Yeah, it's possible. And I think pro-lifers need to be careful not to overstate our case. But at this particular moment, the promise just isn't there.
All right. I was reading through the initiative itself, Scott. And I noticed something as I was reading through it, and I don't know why it caught my eye, but it did. A 14-day limit. That is, the product of somatic cell nuclear transfer, which the initiative refuses to refer to as an embryo, can be used for biomedical research up until 14 days. And then the law prohibits anything after 14 days. I assume it has to be destroyed or frozen or something like that, but you cannot extract stem cells after that. I was just curious, and I asked Don Rubin about that 14-day limit. Why does the law being proposed here limit it to 14 days?
That's a good question. And to some extent, these standards are also intended to deal with concerns expressed by those who have even some science fiction kinds of concerns. So those who believe, against any scientific basis, that those cells left in the lab dish for longer could grow into something. This alleviates that concern.
All right. Do you think the limit's there is just to humor those of us who think that this lab dish thing might grow into something?
His bill that he's referencing, the Missouri Cure Bill, is a little different than what we've seen in New Jersey, though I'm not entirely convinced that it avoids the same problems. And let me explain what I mean by that. In New Jersey, the law is simply that you are free to experiment on any cloned human being as long as you kill the cloned human before birth. And most of the states that are passing cloning legislation, similar to the cloning initiative proposed here, basically say that as long as you kill the clone and don't bring it to birth, you're free to use it for research as long as you want. Now, this 14-day limit that he's talking about models what you see in the U.S. Senate right now with the Feinstein-Hatch bill, which says it will only be 14 days. There is some weaselly language, though, that I need to do a little more research on, because that's funny. I was just reading that myself, that what you referenced a couple of days ago, and I thought, I've got to go back into this initiative and read it from top to bottom to make sure that 14-day limit is a firm one. But I think it's true. They're putting it there to comfort us and to say, oh, look, it's no big deal. But here's the problem, Todd. A 14-day-old human embryo or a one-day-old human embryo is still a human embryo, and to kill it to get its stem cells is immoral.
They insist that in the lab or in the petri dish, which was the term that Don Rubin, the
right.
president of Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures, they insist that there is no way that this cell, these group of cells, as they would put it, could develop into anything in a laboratory setting. It has to be implanted to develop into anything. Is that necessarily true?
No. In the future, it's going to be possible to sustain life in an artificial womb. I agree that right now we can't sustain them beyond that 14-day or perhaps 21-day stage in some cases, as some research indicates. But it doesn't follow it will always be that case. And again, how does where we are have any bearing on who we are? I could also argue that a newborn left alone in a closet somewhere has no potential to develop into a two-year-old. Its potential for growth is zero at that point. Unless it gets outside assistance, it's not going to grow and develop. So I'm not sure in principle what the point of his argument really is here.
Okay, here's the final cut that we have from Don Rubin, president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures. It came near the end of the conversation, and he brought up the issue of the leftover embryos from in vitro fertilization. He addressed this issue this way.
Well, there are 400,000 of these frozen fertilized eggs around the country. And there is a program of adoption called the Snowflake Adoption. And I believe that something like 50 or 60 couples have adopted those. And we're all for that. That's wonderful. But in the meantime, there will be hundreds of thousands that will be thrown away as medical waste. And rather than throwing those away, wouldn't it be better to use them to cure disease, to save lives, to alleviate human suffering? It seems to me that that's a much better choice than throwing them away as medical waste.
All right, Scott, what's your response?
Well, first of all, he's wrong on the numbers. He's right that there are 400,000 embryos out there on ice, so to speak, to put it crudely. But it doesn't follow that all 400,000 of them have been released for medical research, not unless you want to override the parents who have rights to those embryos. The fact is, we have only about 10% of those embryos that are even available for research. The rest are still being held onto by the parents. So what does Mr. Rubin want to do? Go into these families and say, tough luck, we're sorry, we are going to take your offspring that is currently in the fertility lab, and too bad. Unless he's willing to do that, it's kind of odd that he would brag about 400,000 being available. Secondly, his argument also assumes the embryos in question are not human beings. Imagine if I said to you, Todd, that I had an orphanage over in Cambodia in 1975. The Khmer Rouge were coming to attack me, and I knew that these children in the orphanage would probably be killed by the Khmer Rouge. But a researcher showed up and said, hey, I'll take these kids off your hands. They're going to die anyway. Why don't we go ahead and use their organs to treat disease in other people who have a chance to live? It would be a shame to let all these organs go to waste when these children are going to be killed anyway. If I turn those kids in my charge over to the medical researcher, I would be complicit in the evil of destroying them. True, I may not be able to save them, but I should never take active steps to kill them. And that's what would be done here when we say, oh, these embryos are going to die anyway, so let's just go ahead and directly kill them for research. It only works if you assume the embryos are not already human beings.
Again and again and again here, Scott, we come back to this question of who is the embryo?
Yeah, what is it? And he doesn't want to deal with that question other than to lie through his teeth and say medical research has a consensus that until it's implanted, it's not a human being. And I challenge him to come back on your show and present one credible piece of medical literature evidence, peer-reviewed, that will back that claim up. And for everyone he comes up with, if he even comes up with something, and I would be shocked if he could, we'll find 20 others that dispute it.
I commented with our listeners after our Rubin interview that the only way a person in Missouri can sign their name to this petition knowingly, I mean, people do mm-hmm. sign this thinking that they're actually signing the opposite of they think they're actually signing a petition that would achieve the opposite of what it really does. I don't want to come back to that, but I made the comment, look, knowingly, you can only vote for the Missouri Stem Cell Initiative if you are willing to ignore the embryo.
That's right. Exactly right. And, you know, it's really sad, Todd. I think a lot of Christians will go to the polls and vote for this either out of ignorance or a worldview that is not informed by a cross-centered gospel. And it's just too bad that our parishioners and our Christian lay people are not running to their pastors and saying, you will clarify this from the pulpit. You will make sure that our people understand what's really at stake here. Don't give us this nonsense that we're not going to get tied up in political issues. This is a moral issue. The definition of human value is up for grabs. This is big biotech doing some really bad stuff in the name of compassion. And if the church won't stand up and clarify the confusion, who's going to do it? So I would challenge your listeners to demand of their clergy that since the media won't clarify this confusion, it's up to clergy to make sure at least that Christians are informed on what's at stake here.
You mentioned before, and we just talked about how people may be voting for this, thinking that they're voting to ban all human cloning. When we talked with Dr. Bill Hurlbut about this last week from the President's Council mm-hmm. on Bioethics, he was especially incensed about that. He talked about it as a disservice to democracy. This is not – if you want to get this kind of stuff pushed forward and you really want the democratic process to work in this, then be honest and see if people will really vote for it. What does it tell you that they have to be dishonest to get people to vote for it?
Well, it tells us that they have to legalize this stuff on the sly because the public, once informed, probably won't go for it. I mean, seriously, Todd, if we stood up and said, okay, here's your choice come November. Do you think human embryos should be created through a cloning process for the express purpose of destroying them for medical research? Yay or nay? Put that way, do we really think the majority of people in Missouri are going to push the yes lever? I don't think so. It might be, it may not be a landslide in favor of those opposed to this research, but I don't believe it would be a victory for those who favor it. I really think they have to use very sly techniques and language to have a hope at getting this to pass.
I want to hear from you on the Missouri Stem Cell Initiative and our interview with Don Rubin, president of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. In about 15 minutes, audio open lines will begin with President Bill Clinton. Well, he'd been talking, former President Bill Clinton had been talking recently about values, and we'll play that for you during audio open lines and some other audio, get your reaction there as well. Okay, you mentioned how people might vote out of ignorance or really consciously be voting for something like this. I want to take that second group of people.
Yeah.
We heard from them in our reaction to the Don Rubin interview. Who they call and say, look, I know it's an embryo. I know that all these things are true. I'm not going to fiddle around with ideas like pre-embryo. But look, you can't compare the nearly undeveloped human embryo with my kid who may have juvenile diabetes who could be cured by this. Your response? I mean, they've got their eyes wide open. They know exactly what the embryo is.
Well, if somebody comes to you, Todd, and says, I know that toddler over there is a human being, I'm not going to pretend by using misleading language that he's not, but I'm going to kill him anyway to cure my own kid. That person doesn't need an argument. They really need a psychologist, because once we reduce morality to my personal interest and we throw out all moral principles because of my self-interest, society has a whole lot bigger problem than Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease. And that's what's being expressed there, a really radical form of utilitarianism that says if it's useful for me or the people I love, I'll be glad to kill other people I don't love to meet my own ends. And that's a sad commentary on where we are. Now, I understand the rhetorical force of it. It's one thing, for example, for a parent to say, given a choice between saving the life of my own kid in a burning building and saving the lives of 20 other people in another room somewhere, I'm going to make my first priority getting my own kid out. That makes sense. But on the way out, we wouldn't slit the throats of the other 20 people, nor would we kill them so that we could get out. Rather, we would make a choice to save our own family members first, but we wouldn't directly be killing someone else in the process of doing that. What these people are suggesting is, you know, basically ethics, who cares? I'm going to do what feels right for me and my family, and that's just the way it is.
So what do you make of the comment made by Don Rubin in one of those recent sound bites we just played, where he says, look, we all agree on the ethics, and no one thinks that we should take a life to save a life?
Well, first of all, we don't agree on the ethics. He's being disingenuous there. He's trying to feign some agreement to score some points. Anybody that basically argues that moral principle should be submitted to scientific progress doesn't hold the same ethics view I do. When you believe that science and science alone has the right to determine what's right and wrong, that is an ethical worldview that is very different than the one a duty-bound Christian is going to hold to, or even a person who holds to classical ethical systems like Aristotelian ethics. So he is wrong about that. But again, he is assuming these embryos are not human beings, and that's what allows him to make that claim in the first place.
I mean, the sad thing about this, Scott, is that if they get enough signatures and their ad campaign and their rhetoric is successful, this thing will probably sail through.
Yeah, I think it will, barring an unbelievable effort from the state's clergy who are concerned about this and Christian educators. And I'll tell you, I'm not real hopeful we're going to pull it off, barring that kind of effort.
I mean, wouldn't it be a story? I'm thinking also about the media, and I'm not a big advocate of media bias, but
right.
Because I think it's a little more balanced than most people do. But wouldn't it be a story for the media to say, let's look at the other side of this issue and ask whether or not the truth is being told by the ads in the Missouri stem cell initiative?
Yeah. Now, Wesley J. Smith, who's a very good bioethicist, has written an op-ed piece that, thankfully, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch did print. But that's only after they've run, 20 other op-eds saying that positions like his are just plain nuts, and then followed by other op-eds who allegedly refuted his. And so the representation here is nowhere near equal. And I agree with you. It would be really nice if the press would instead of just printing their agenda, would actually go after this and say, we want to take an intellectually honest look at it. I don't see that happening in Missouri or, quite frankly, anywhere else in the country.
Why is that? Not to beat up on the press, but why is that someone doesn't take advantage of the story that's waiting there to be told?
I don't know, Todd, other than that the majority of people in the press, as survey after survey has shown, have a very left-of-center worldview. And that worldview seeps into their reporting, as David Shaw wrote in the L.A. Times years ago, about how that liberal bias on bioethical issues like abortion seeps into the news. And we're not talking here only about editorials, we're talking here about news coverage. And I wish I knew why there weren't more enterprising reporters out there that would like to break the big story and, you know, come up with their own little Watergate story here that blows the lid off what's really going on.
Two quick final questions, 30 seconds apiece.
Yeah.
Don Rubin in our interview, we didn't have the audio for this, but he said near the end of our interview, look, even if you think that this is ethically wrong, don't let Missouri residents be second-class citizens. If you don't vote for this, the Missouri residents won't be able to take advantage of all the cures that will come from embryonic stem cell research. So don't let Missouri do it for Missouri.
Well, first of all, they can take advantage because this, even if this doesn't pass, nothing in our nation at the federal level bans embryonic stem cell research. All it bans is your federal tax dollars being used for it. So it's simply untrue that they would be denied this. The second thing is, if it's unethical, we should be denied it. And that's the question. Is it ethical to kill a human embryo so that other humans can benefit?
Then finally, how should someone respond to a coworker who walks up to them and says, look, I saw that commercial about the stem cell initiative here in Missouri. Isn't it amazing? Isn't it exciting to be living this day and age? And what will be discovered if we pass this bill?
I would use Hadley Arkus's soundbite, and here's what it would be. Given a choice between a cure that is lethal for a human subject and one that is not lethal, wouldn't we be inclined to choose the non-lethal treatment, especially when the non-lethal treatment is doing very well curing diseases while the lethal treatment is currently treating no diseases? I think that's the way to frame it, because you get the ethics and the practical realities into the same soundbite. The ethics, it's wrong to kill one human being to benefit another. The practical side of it, the adult stem cells, which are not controversial, are curing 64 diseases. The highly controversial embryonic stem cells are treating none.
Real quickly, Scott, do you know of any other states where something like this is soon to arrive, something like this major media push on the part of the Missouri Coalition for Life-Saving Cures?
I think you're going to see it in Florida. I think you're going to see it in Washington. In fact, Washington already flirted with this. California, of course, has already run right up to this and done it, in essence. And the only difference is they're using unbelievable high numbers of tax dollars to fund this thing in a state that's already bankrupt. You're going to see it in Maryland. You're going to see it, I think, in probably 20 to 25 states in the next 3 to 4 years.
Folks, for some great pro-life resources, check out the Life Training Institute's website tonight. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click links, and you'll find a direct link to Scott Klusendorf and Life Training Institute. He is president of Life Training Institute and a regular guest here on Issues Etc. Scott, thanks again.
Thanks, Todd.
Well, when we come back from this break, we have got audio open lines for you. President Bill Clinton, former President Bill Clinton, was out and about addressing the issue of values, talking about which values have a stronger root in the Bible. And we'll play a little bit of that. His wife as well, saying a few things, the senator from New York. And it's audio open lines, lots more audio to play for you. And then we're going to play Name That Religion in the last half hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.